You're with us for the morning show as we talk about scientific collaboration and what happens when a hive of researchers, physicians, scientists from all disciplines come together to tackle a global pandemic crisis and try to defeat a virus. This hour involves microscopes, and our guest saved up from her babysitting money to buy her first one at age 12. What do you want to know about how scientists from different fields collaborate on projects? Do you have faith in the scientific community to develop a vaccine, to find a cure, to solve unthinkable problems? We're talking STEM throughout the hour. It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Joe Handelsman is director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison. She's also a professor in the Department of Plant Pathology, where she researches the genetic and functional diversity of microorganisms. She's authored more than 200 scientific research publications. Joe, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, when I think of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, I think of so much hands-on, shoulder-to-shoulder collaboration in promoting science and solving scientific problems. How are you doing that in this pandemic?
Well, it's been an interesting challenge. We were banned from the lab for the first couple of months when people were hunkering down at home and trying to get this virus under control. Then we were allowed to come back starting June 1st. We developed a plan that allowed people to work in the lab, but under very safe and very cautious conditions. We had shifts, so only a few people were in the lab at a time. Everyone wore masks. That's an absolute requirement for the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery and also now for campus as well. And we made sure that there was social distancing in the lab, which, as you can imagine, with people moving around and using different equipment, is kind of a challenge. But our lab workers were really dedicated to keeping each other healthy, and so far it's worked perfectly.
Yeah, well, I mean, these studies have to go on. The research has to go on. And some things you can't just put on ice. How is the research doing?
Well, I think the research in many of the research groups is back to close to normal. I don't think that the researchers' lives are back to normal, because I know there are some that are working late at night and early in the morning, hours they might not have worked otherwise, because we're trying to keep the density of people low at any given time. But their work is going well. So we're just thrilled to be back at the bench and producing data and studying the problems that we find so fascinating.
At that bench have been so many grad students and undergrads who help further this research, too. They're in the background and oftentimes invisible. How is this research going when they're not in the equation?
Well, they are back in the equation. First, we had graduate students come back and postdocs and technicians, and that was the first wave of people in June who started working in the lab very carefully. And then we recently added undergraduates to the equation as well. And so the labs are starting to feel a little bit more normal now.
How are they doing in terms of the social distancing and all of the precautions? What type of precautions do you have in place?
Well, we have, as I said, the low density of people. So we make sure that there's always 6 feet between people. That's kind of challenging when one person is trying to teach another person a technique. So we've been exploring plexiglass dividers. We happen to have a lot of glass in our building, which helps because sometimes one person can stand on one side of the glass outside the lab and the other one can be inside demonstrating, and they might only be a foot apart, but they're separated by glass. So we're using as many creative ways to keep people healthy as we can. And then we've also started a campaign. Another professor and I in the institute have started making masks for everybody in the institute. And we had a very interesting time of reading all the literature we could find on what materials were best for masks, unless, you know, if you didn't have an N95 mask, which our people don't, what would be the best materials to block the virus. And we've just started making them at a pretty high production rate. And so all of our researchers have access to really good masks now.
Yeah, we were just talking about masks. What type of fabric did you settle on?
Well, there was a very interesting study that showed that a very densely woven cotton, so high thread count, combined with a satin or chiffon or silk, something very electrostatic, you know, those fabrics that cling to you when, especially in dry weather, that combination is particularly effective. And the thought is that the densely woven cotton blocks the virus physically, so it kind of sieves it out. And then the more electrostatic, staticky materials will bind aerosols, the water droplets that carry the virus, just through a charge interaction, you know, positive and negative charges. And so the combination seems to be extremely effective. So the method we've settled on is two layers of this densely woven cotton with two layers of satin or chiffon in the middle. And then we're adding a new angle to them now of putting wire all the way around so that inside, so it's not uncomfortable. And that we're hoping will help it conform to the face, because the research shows that apart from whatever fabric you use for the mask, the biggest variable is the leaks around the edges, you know, gaps between the face and the mask. So we're trying to overcome that.
You know, as a microbiologist, did you ever imagine that you would be doing mask output and design production?
No, I really didn't think that was part of my job description. But I have to say, there's been something tremendously satisfying about it, because I think we all feel so physically separated from the people that we're used to working with every day. And this is just a small way of feeling connected with them. It makes me feel really good when I'm sitting at the sewing machine knowing that one of my people in WID is going to be wearing that mask.
Mm. Joe Handelsman with us, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison. We're looking at the work of scientists, the collaboration amid the pandemic, taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Joe, scientists around the world are just working feverishly to battle the coronavirus, to come up with a vaccine. How do you see these scientists working together across borders, across countries, to find treatments and maybe even a cure?
Well, scientists have always been really good at working across borders. I've always said that science is the best kind of diplomacy we have, because when scientists go into their science mode, they kind of forget all language, political, and geographic barriers between them, and they just find the common ground of the scientific language and the scientific ideas. And so I think science, as much as any discipline in the world, has always reached across those borders, because it's about ideas. People are just hungry for the good ideas and people who can help them develop those ideas. So the collaborations, I think, have always been a strength of science, and that has really come into play in any kind of crisis, but right now in the coronavirus. One of the things that I have just so appreciated is the willingness of scientists to share their data before they even publish the data. And so Professor David O'Connor here at UW developed an open website where he puts all of the data that people send him from the coronavirus field across the world onto a single website so that all the researchers can access it. We don't have to wait for publication or anything.
Wow. So true open source there. Joe Handelsman, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, with us. What do you wonder about how scientists reach conclusions? What have you heard about how scientists struggle to hold on to grant funding or staffing or how to keep their research going? Time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about cooperative science and where it can lead. It's an hour-long conversation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So much about the coronavirus is still a mystery. There are no approved vaccines, but vaccines eradicated smallpox and polio. They brought measles, diphtheria, and rubella in check. And it's the scientists. It's the scientists we can thank for curbing infectious diseases. What messages do you have for the scientific community now? Are you a researcher in a lab? What problems are you trying to solve at your bench? How close are you to the answer? Join in 800-642-1234. Jo Handelsman is director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, and she stays with us. Jo, you were talking there about David O'Connor, the scientist, opening up so many data sets, so much information before it hits publication, so that other scientists, I would assume, can use that data from their own vantage point on their own research?
Exactly. And it's been really rewarding to see how people use other groups' data, because it may be that someone else has data that will answer a question that some gap in our own data leaves. And so it's the way to do science is to share. And I think that's a principle in general in the scientific community, but it has really come to the fore in the coronavirus epidemic because everyone is so dedicated to understanding it, understanding the spread, understanding how to treat it, and eventually develop vaccines.
Yeah, so you're seeing that sharing going to a whole new level.
Exactly. I think it's international, national, and across fields.
So you talked there about one example. There is other work going on at the Institute contributing to this international effort to combat COVID-19. What else is going on?
So WIT has a variety of research programs, but some of the really exciting frontiers are due to the co-location of people in diverse disciplines. And we try to build a community of very diverse people with different backgrounds in different fields. And it's interesting to watch the collisions of ideas as people begin to talk about what's important to them scientifically and what they know about and how that might have an effect on someone else's work. And there's a real, creative spark that develops, and inspiration comes from those sparks, and new solutions come from those sparks. So one group, for example, is using big data, a group of data scientists, new ways of looking at big data to understand how cells differentiate, for example, how stem cells become other kinds of cells, become tissues, and how the patterns of gene expression dictate that process. And the data sets these days in biology are so enormous. We have literally thousands and thousands of data points on thousands of genes over time. And when you start multiplying that out, you can see that it's a staggering amount of information. And so we really need the modern data science methods involving machine learning and very high level, high dimensionality statistics to be able to tackle those data sets and make sense of them. So that's the kind of collaboration that occurs at WID that we think is really leading to new insights. Another group is studying what we call the gut-brain axis, and that's the connection between the gut in the mammalian system and all the bacteria that live in that gut, the microbiome, and the signals that go to the brain. So we have a fabulous group working on neural tissue and building little tiny brain organoids in the test tube. And we want to study the signals that bacteria may send through the nervous system to affect brain development, how the brain functions and how it dictates behavior.
Let me introduce you. Microbiologist Jo Handelsman is with us, directs the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, WID, at UW-Madison. It's a gathering place for collaborations that she's been talking about, scientific research, and then the public outreach that's reinventing how it works in the COVID era. Taking your questions about science, what are your thoughts on how scientific researchers can get the work done in the pandemic? What do you want to know about reaching conclusions and about publishing? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jo, you mentioned their stem cell research, and that has had a very fraught past, controversial past. Where are we at with stem cell research?
Well, I think that stem cell research has become a little bit less controversial in the last 10 years. President Obama removed, when he first got into office, one of the very first things he did was to remove some of the regulation of stem cell research, and that enabled researchers to explore different kinds of stem cells in different kinds of laboratory settings with different kinds of funding. It really opened up the field. And I think that as solutions have begun to get very close in the near term, and in some cases even used in the clinic, I think that people are a little less worried about stem cells. They realize that these are natural cells. People have started to be able to use even skin cells to become, they can turn them back into stem cells and then re-differentiate them into a given tissue. That kind of takes away some of the ethical and issues around using embryonic stem cells, which don't necessarily have to be used in stem cell research. And so I think it's really just a common part of biology research these days. And so there's some really exciting work going on regenerating tissue for a variety of diseases with the hope that that tissue that can be regenerated will essentially treat or cure the diseases.
You mentioned President Obama, and you worked in the White House as Associate Director for Science at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. During your time there, what did it teach you about the role of science policy and how it's handled, you know, across the U.S. and even internationally?
Well, I had no idea before I went to the White House just how much science comes across the president's desk. In fact, when I asked the person who was hiring me, John Holdren, why the president wanted me, and he said, oh, you wouldn't believe how much microbiology crosses the president's desk. And I thought, oh, come on, microbiology crossing the president's desk. Well, I was quite surprised when I got there that that was absolutely true. And so it was amazing to me how much of the actual science, the day-to-day science, President Obama became engaged in. And his entire administration was very evidence-based, whether it was financial or economic policy or social policy or criminal justice. He always wanted to see the data. And so, of course, science was no exception to that. And he had a great affection for science, which was kind of rewarding as a scientist. He was always eager to learn the real details of the science. And it was striking how much more science he knew than many of his aides, the people around him. And it extended to collaborations with other governments. And I had the privilege of representing the United States to the G7 science ministers and also to the G20 science ministers. And it was really kind of a humbling experience to see all these high-level scientists from other countries all talking about the scientific issues. Every country was dealing with the same issues. They shared solutions, tried to develop collaborative projects across, for example, between Europe and the U.S., between Japan and the United States, to try to solve common problems. And so it really, science really is at the policy level, both a global issue and a national policy issue. And it was really important to have a variety, many, many scientists. I think at the peak, the office that I was part of, the Office of Science and Technology Policy, I think had 135 scientists on board. And it was really important to have that variety of expertise, because when the president needed expertise in a given field, we pretty much had it. And if we didn't have it in-house, we found that the scientific community, any place in the country, probably any place in the world, was eager to help us.
What should be done, in your view, to combat a growing anti-science stance that we're seeing emerge in society? Some politicians currently have. I'm thinking climate science in particular.
Well, I think there's an interesting dichotomy between science in the general sense and climate science in particular, and then COVID-19. Where it seems like everyone wants scientific answers. Even people who don't really believe that the epidemic is going to hit them or it be a problem, they kind of still will say, oh, but there'll be a vaccine, so I'm not worried about it. Well, that's relying on scientists to come up with solutions. So I've been struck by how important science has become in this epidemic. And one scientist in particular, Tony Fauci from the National Institutes of Health, I think has been a tremendous ambassador for science, because not only is he a wonderful person and a brilliant scientist, but he has this just innate capacity to make science accessible and understanding and even interesting to the public. And so I think he's been really effective at translating scientific data and also what we don't know. That's one of the things I love about what Fauci does, is he talks about the limit of science. And when we don't have the data, he says so. And that's a really important thing, that we don't always have the answers. That's why we do science, is to find out answers.
Well, let's pause there with Joe Handelsman, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison. We'll be back with her right after this news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we spend the hour understanding how the scientific community is rising to the challenge of this global health crisis and what's happening at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison. Scientists have so much on their plate: pandemics, climate change, food and clean water shortages. The scope of these problems, it seems overwhelming. We're learning how scientists are collaborating, how they're taking on these bite-sized chunks, working with their peers, open data. Still time for your questions, your observations about scientific research and the study in the pandemic at 800-642-1234. We have microbiologist Joe Handelsman, who is our guide, and she directs the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. Joe, I just love the story about you as a young kid loving science and how you saved up your babysitting money to get your first microscope. It was just so awesome. And I'm wondering what you would tell to young people out there who do like science but keep it hidden.
Well, the first thing is, I just love hearing of young people who are excited about science, and I would tell them that it is just a wonderful life and a wonderful career. One of the things about science that's so great is it's always new. We're always exploring new questions. When we answer one question, we move on to the next, and usually each question generates lots of new questions. And so it's a really wonderful way to spend your life. The other thing about science is that there are so many different jobs that one can do with science. You can apply science in so many different settings, from, you know, communication, being in the media, to working in the law, to, like I did briefly, for, you know, working in government. There are just so many aspects of life these days that are touched by science, that in addition to being a bench scientist and studying questions directly, applying science is a very important part of what we do.
Have you held on to your first microscope?
Oh, yes. I have it in my office. In fact, I'm working from home right now, and I was thinking, next time I go in to deliver a load of masks to my colleagues, I was thinking perhaps I should bring my microscope home, because I'm used to having it right near me when I work.
Oh, that must be, you must cherish it, because it's your first memories of being curious about the world and putting everything you could under a microscope.
Yeah, some of my most vivid memories are the hours and hours I would spend at the microscope looking at everything from pond water and looking at little creatures that would run around on the surface of the water to microorganisms. To crystals that I looked at with polarizing light that made them look act like prisms and look beautiful. Those were some of the best years I ever had as a child, were with my microscope.
We don't have enough women in science. It is a huge problem here in the U.S. and in other parts of the world. What are we doing to change that?
Well, I think We don't have enough women, and we don't have enough people of color. We don't have enough people from certain kinds of backgrounds in the United States. Scientists need to be more diverse, because science is better when we have diverse communities. And that's not just an opinion. That's really based on scientific studies that show that groups of people that are more diverse are more creative. So it's critical not just for women and people of color, but also for science itself to bring in a broader array of scientists. We're trying to provide more role models of women and people of color to inspire young kids to be in the science. It's very discouraging if you can't see someone who looks like you. It's hard to imagine being that person. And so for kids, we really need those role models who look like them. We also need mentors who don't necessarily have to look like the person that they're mentoring, but need to care about helping people along every step of the way and giving them advice and encouragement. One of the things we see is that kids who come from backgrounds, families of scientists, are much more comfortable. It's much easier for them to become scientists. And I think part of that is understanding the concept of failure. Kids think that if they fail, if an experiment fails or they fail an exam, that they're intrinsically not good at that area of study. And that's just simply not true. First of all, science is about failure. Most of our experiments do fail. If we knew the answer, we wouldn't have to do experiments. And so that's a principle of science. And also, science is hard. And there's no question about that everyone who's in science has failed at something. And that should not be considered a referendum on a student's abilities. So part of it is just telling people the stories of scientists and why we love what we're doing, but some of the bumps along the road that it's not easy. And if it's not easy, don't assume that that means you're not good at it.
So what tangible things have you done at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery to change the dynamics there to make it more inclusive?
Well, one of the things we've done very regularly is remind people about the importance of diversity and talk about the research on diversity in science and why including a diverse group of people is a better way to do science and also important for the people we include. We've also talked quite a bit about the research on unconscious bias, which is the set of prejudices that we all bring, every one of us bring to our dealings with other people. It's a set of assumptions that our unconscious minds apply to the view we have of the world generally, but specifically in this case of people. And those biases lead us to think that, not consciously, but unconsciously think that scientists are white men. And there's been a lot of research on this that shows that if you can dispel those unconscious biases, and they're impossible to get rid of, they're kind of wired in there once we're adults. But if we can get people not to apply them and be aware of them and try to control the effect of bias, then we have a much better chance of building a diverse community. So we train very broadly. We train search committees when they're looking for new people to hire. We train them in unconscious bias and how to overcome the effects of those biases on their selections. We talk about some of the research. I did a study in 2012 where we simply sent out a description of a student to scientists, biologists, chemists, physicists across the country, and then asked a series of questions of whether they'd hire the person, how much they'd pay them, did they think the person was competent, would they mentor them. And we randomly put the name Jennifer on half of them and the name John on half of them. And of course, like many studies before ours, we found that there was a big difference in how people treated Jennifer and John, even though their resumes were exactly the same. There was not a word different except the pronouns we used. So talking about experiments like that is very powerful to scientists. Scientists are swayed by data. So that's a big thing of what we do is talking about data. And most recently, we've been talking about what it means to be an anti-racist and what are some of the tools that we have. How can we actually bring anti-racism into our day-to-day lives?
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Joe Handelsman, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, WID, the acronym, at UW-Madison. It's a research space focused on interdisciplinary research, public outreach as well in science. You can join in with your questions. Are you pursuing a job in science? What specific field interests you? What questions do you have about how a lab operates? Join in at 800-642-1234. Joe, there is a project at WID about science to street art. Can you tell us about science to street art and its way of connecting with young people?
That's one of my favorite projects that we've developed at WID. I've always been very interested in the fusion of art and science and using literature and visual arts and film to make science more connected to people and help people enter the world of science. And so one of my staff, Ginger Ann Contreras, started this movement to develop murals around Madison that depict science in its best form, interdisciplinary science, diverse science, people in science who are diverse, and science that affects people's lives. And we've contracted with a group of really, I think, tremendously gifted artists who have painted these murals around Madison, including one within the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery building. The Discovery building has this big white wall that was just calling out for a mural. And so that's where we had a mural painted about the diversity of people in science. And it depicts all different kinds of people and many scientists who are important in this history of science, but who people haven't necessarily heard of. So those are the kinds of things that we try to bring to kids and adults to make science more accessible, to make the ideas of science more familiar so they pass them every day, and to show that science is a beautiful thing, because the murals are gorgeous, in my opinion, but also involve a very diverse group of people.
Where might we see these murals? Where do they pop up?
So there are two near the Meadowood Mall. There is the one in the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, and there are a couple more going up. They were started before COVID, and I think they're almost finished, but I have to get a report on that as well.
We are getting a deeper sense of how the scientific world operates in these times with UW-Madison microbiologist Joe Handelsman as our guide. She leads the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, or WID. How do you think we should elevate more women and people of color into leadership roles in the STEM fields? What questions do you have about current research on stem cells or other areas, vaccine research? Still time to talk. Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Joe Handelsman right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with environmental microbiologist Joe Handelsman. She's director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, and we're learning about the research pursuits of scientists in these trying times and how collaborations work in WID and also how to solve these vexing problems around our world. Let's take a call now. Lou is joining us from Cudahy this morning. Hi, Lou.
Hi there. How unfortunate. It's clear that even the hard sciences now have been politicized. And she's also introduced identity politics with that, and the nasty experience of identity politics, where you are identified based on the color of your skin or your social class. And finally, the virtue signaling coming from her, because she believes, as she do most people who think like her, that they're morally superior.
Lou, I want to step in there. And Joe, your insights as we look at bringing more diversity to the sciences.
Well, you know, the belief that scientists are somehow morally superior is actually the antithesis of what we believe and what we've been trying to do. One of the things that I found very striking was one of our murals is on the side of Luna's Market in Madison. And the owner of the market was really quite eloquent about why this was so important to her to have this mural on her market. And it was partly about reaching the people of her community with science, but also showing that her market was scientifically driven and comfortable with scientific principles, which, of course, is a very important thing in food management. Scientific principles adhere there. So, in fact, I would say that the caller, perhaps I misspoke or he misunderstood, but we're actually trying to convince people of the opposite, that anyone can be a scientist. And we want the public engaged. That's the whole idea of science to street art, is we welcome people to the Discovery Building, not during COVID-19, but before that. We have many, many events that bring people in. But we also have a dedication to reaching the public, and that's what led Ginger Ann to develop this reaching out to the public with the murals.
It must be difficult right now because you have done so much public outreach in the past, drawing people in to the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. How do you reconcile that? How do you make science accessible when we are not able to gather in spaces?
It's very painful, given the dedication that our building has, and the town center, which is the wonderful facility of the first floor, run by Laura Heisler, who does most of the outreach programming. We have such a capacity for reaching the public that it's been very painful not to be able to live up to that. But I've been struck by how even online we've been able to reach a broad community of people. There have been several broadcasts of panel discussions about various topics, including COVID-19, from groups within the Discovery Building that have been tremendously well attended. I think I moderated one where we had 500 participants, even though it was online. And so I think that it is possible to reach people. People are so hungry for connection and for scientific understanding right now that they do respond when we reach out. And of course, it's not the same as having events around our murals or in the lobby of our building or taking people on tours of the laboratories, but it certainly is an effective substitute.
I don't want to run out of time before we can talk about your research pursuits in microbial communities and their influence on human health and crop productivity. What are you trying to discover in your own lab?
My lab works on microbial communities in a variety of habitats, from soil to the human gut. But the main thrust is trying to understand how microbial communities, so mixtures of different species of bacteria, do what they do. And how do they, for example, resist being invaded by alien species? How do they, how does an invader successfully invade? What are the characteristics of a microbe that knows how to invade a community? And then what makes the community able to function doing what it does? And the longer-term goals are to try to generate communities on plant roots and in soil that are more productive and keep the soil healthier. And this is based on a very serious concern about the fact that we're losing our soil at a very high clip across the world. And if we knew better how to get carbon from plants into microbes and then into the soil, we might be able to stabilize some of that soil. So that's the longer-term goal, is looking at the interaction between the plant and the microbes and the soil.
And this is a complex area, I would assume, and a very, organic process. What have you learned?
Well, we know that small molecules, which are like antibiotics and related kinds of compounds, are very important for microbial communities in soil. And we found that some antibiotics actually act as signals in communities. And so they, even though we use them for killing bacteria, bacteria produce them in order to talk to each other. And some of them use them for killing. But we think that more often these antibiotics are used as communication vehicles, and they're ways of bacteria detecting each other and then behaving accordingly once they have a catalog of who's around them based on those small molecules. So we find the relationship of chemistry to biology, these small chemicals that are produced by the bacteria, to be one of the most powerful areas of biology today.
We're talking with Joe Handelsman, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison. She's also a professor in the Department of Plant Pathology, where she researches this genetic and functional diversity of microorganisms. Still time for your questions about science, 800-642-1234. Joe, I'm wondering, how do you juggle it all? How can you carry on that, your own scientific research, your own lab, juggle the demands of running the institute and so many other labs that are going on around you? How do you prioritize?
Well, I have amazing people. I certainly don't do it all. I have an incredible staff in the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. The assistant director, Beth Misko, is on top of essentially every detail. It seems like she knows everything there is to know about WID. So I don't have to do everything. We have a staff that does finances and outreach and communications and computer technology. I mean, they're really incredibly talented and diverse. In my lab, similarly, I have an amazing group of about 10 researchers who carry on their research with creativity and dedication, and they just love what they're doing. Mm. So, and then the rest of the institute is made up of incredibly dedicated and excited researchers, people who really care about the work that they do. So that makes it a lot easier. And sure, it's busy, but there are great people doing the work.
In our last, few seconds here, how is funding for these labs, and are researchers able to find the funds they need in order to carry on their studies?
Well, the thing that's frustrated me in science since I've been a scientist is that there is a lot of funding for science. You know, the National Institutes of Health budget is well over $30 billion today. And that provides a lot of funding for research in this country, as does the National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, many others. But the problem is getting the really high-risk, high-payoff research funded. And that's what we continue to struggle with. And that was a major thrust of my work before COVID-19 hit, was beginning to try to raise the funds to do to provide the flexibility for researchers to try out new ideas, to hire a new student to try out something that they're interested in, or to collaborate across fields. And so that's the area that I think we will continue to struggle with for a while.
Joe, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate. It's been great.
Joe Handelsman, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison. Just ahead, it is On Point. COVID-19 is surging all over the globe again, even in countries that seem to achieve the new normal. On Point discusses the current state of the pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.